This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 21, 2003. In Caracas, Venezuela, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Worldwide sentiment against a war on Iraq is growing. In a marked change to British immigration policy, Jamaicans now require visas to enter the country. And as the US gets set to mark the 30th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling Roe v. Wade, we take a look at women's reproductive rights in other parts of the world. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Late this afternoon, the U.S. Senate is expected to vote unanimously for former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge to become the first Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
The Senate Governmental Affairs Committee unanimously approved Ridge last week, who said during the committee hearing that, quote, America is undoubtedly safer and better prepared today than on September 10, 2001. Although Democrats and Republicans alike have praised Ridge, members of both parties challenged that assertion and questioned the president's domestic security priorities, including what some perceive as an underfunding of domestic law enforcement and emergency medical personnel. Although Ridge is likely to be confirmed easily, Democrats will have a second opportunity today to raise these issues on the Senate floor. In Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Nobel Peace Prize winner and former President Jimmy Carter met Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez this morning, where he proposed two alternative solutions to quell the unrest in the South American country. Matt Rogers reports from Caracas.
After a breakfast meeting with President Hugo Chavez, Jimmy Carter held a press conference in which he announced two possible solutions to the current crisis that has virtually paralyzed Venezuela's infrastructure, from closures of schools, shopping malls, and fast food chains to the beginning of widespread worker layoffs and major devaluation of the Venezuelan currency. Carter's first proposal is to adhere to the current constitution, which calls for a national referendum on August 19th of this year in which Chavez and all elected officials can be reinstated or removed by voters. The second proposal that Carter put forward is for a constitutional amendment, which would shorten Chavez's current term and bring forward early national elections in which Chavez would be allowed to run for re-election. President Chavez has indicated he supports both of Carter's proposals. The opposition has yet to respond. Carter says he will also present his proposal this Friday in Washington during the first meeting of the foreign ministers of the six nations that form the so-called Group of Friends of Venezuela. In Caracas, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Rogers.
Firefighters walked off the job today in Britain. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London.
The British public are at the mercy of the military today as firefighters stage a 24-hour strike protesting low wages. Hundreds of untrained military personnel will replace firefighters across the country as workers stand at the picket line. The government has offered an 11% pay rise so far, linked to reforms including job losses and no second jobs that supplement income. The Fire Brigade Union, which brought the strike, has rejected the pay deal outright, demanding 40% instead. Other groups, such as nurses, also want higher pay, and many see the firefighters' dispute as crucial to the outcome of their demands. This is Anastasia Kershaw calling from London for Free Speech Radio News.
French officials have boldly declared they will oppose any attempt by the United States to pass a United Nations resolution calling for military action against Iraq, at least for now. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
Addressing a news conference here on Monday, French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin hinted that his nation could use its veto to block any U.S.-sponsored resolution that calls for war on Iraq, saying, on principles, France will go to the very end.
We should not take the risk to endanger the lives of innocent civilians or soldiers, to jeopardize the stability of the region and further widen the gap between our people and our cultures. We should not take the risk to fuel terrorism.
China has also expressed strong reservations about a possible UN-sponsored military attack on Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
A burgeoning grassroots movement in Mexico is at odds with what they see as President Vicente Fox's continued alignment of Mexican foreign policy with U.S. economic and political interests. Kent Patterson reports.
Scores of rural organizations across Mexico are joining a movement that's demanding the renegotiation of the agricultural and forestry sections of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Representing millions of rural producers, they contend that NAFTA is jeopardizing the livelihoods of farmers who cannot compete with their more technologically advanced counterparts in the U.S. and Canada. Many groups also oppose the proposed free trade area of the Americas. Protests and highway blockades are planned in numerous Mexican states during the next 2 weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting from Mexico.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As President Bush today expressed frustration with allies such as France and Germany's reluctance to wage war on Iraq, sentiment around the world is growing against Washington's war desires. 10,000 people turned out against the war in Tokyo over the weekend in the biggest Japanese demonstration to date against an American war in Iraq. At the same time, Japanese Buddhist monks in Baghdad organized hundreds of Iraqi children for a candlelight ceremony to mark the 12-year anniversary of the first Gulf War. Aaron Glantz has more from Amman, Jordan.
The Buddhist Krongting Orangtang ceremony is usually performed on the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Hundreds of children are assembled carrying candles inside colorful paper shells, with each candle communicating with one of those killed by the attack. Yosei Horikoshi organized the Krongting Orangtang ceremony in Baghdad to mark the 12th anniversary of the start of the Gulf War. He says 200 Iraqi children and 100 adults participated. Horikoshi says it's important for the world to link the carnage of Hiroshima with the first Gulf War. It's a link, he says, that many Japanese people have already made.
During World War II, we completely defeated. So we don't want to make war anymore, you know, because we know what is war, what happened. Through war, we are completely destroyed, you know, everything.
But while a majority of the Japanese public is opposed to a war on Iraq, the Japanese government has already given George Bush its full support for the war. Again, Buddhist monk Yosei Horikoshi.
The Japanese government completely following the American policy. So if America attacked Iraq, Japan automatically involving this war. So Japanese constitution renounce war. So government try to change the constitution.
I think Koizumi is the marionette of Bush.
Michizo Matsusaki is a veteran Japanese newspaper reporter and peace activist who traveled to Baghdad with Giyose Horikoshi. He notes Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi has already moved 80 frigates from the Japanese Navy to the Indian Ocean, just outside the Persian Gulf and within striking distance of Iraq.
Japanese Navy have Aegis frigate without parliament permission. He decide to send Indian Ocean Aegis frigate. This is a very bad policy, I think.
More than 10,000 people turned out to protest Japan's participation in the war on Iraq on the streets of Tokyo this weekend. That may pale in comparison to the number of Americans who marched on Washington. But it's much more than many people expected, says Giyose Horikoshi.
Yeah, many people are against this American war to Iraq. So in Japan also we had many big mass demonstration against the Iraqi attack. So we are in Japan, we are also working together against this attack.
Now outside Iraq, in the Jordanian capital Amman, Giyose Horikoshi is working with a team of Japanese monks and peace activists to Baghdad to bear witness to a possible second Gulf War. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruling that reaffirmed women's rights to medical privacy under the Second Amendment. As pro-choice and reproductive rights advocates prepare to commemorate the date in the United States, health workers in other parts of the world say there's little progress to celebrate. From the WBAI newsroom, Ginger Otis has the story.
In the minds of most Americans, January 22nd is usually associated with the Supreme Court ruling known as Roe v. Wade. But the date also marks another less discussed cultural battle. 3 years ago, on the same date, President Bush reinstated the global gag rule, which cut off U.S. international aid to any family planning organization that engaged, directly or indirectly, in abortion-related activities. But health workers say the decision has cut 99% of the funds that went for contraception services to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Stephen Sinling, Director General of the London-based International Family Planning Organization, describes the global gag rule's effect as disastrous.
We've lost $18 million a year that we had been receiving, about a third of that directly in the form of contraceptive commodities. And virtually all of the money that we've lost is money that we were using to provide clinical and community-based family planning and reproductive health services to women in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America.
Health workers throughout the developing world say that the number of unsafe abortions has shot up in the past 3 years. Shortly after reinstating the global gag rule, President Bush withheld $34 million in funding for birth control, maternal and child health care, and HIV/AIDS prevention from the United Nations Population Fund. Just a few days before the president declared a so-called Sanctity of Life Day in the United States, Gloria Felt of Planned Parenthood spoke at a reproductive rights gathering in New York, where she discussed the number of deaths that can be linked to the Bush administration's compassionate conservatism.
It's important to understand that every minute of every day, somewhere in the world, a woman dies because she doesn't have access to pregnancy-related care, including family planning and safe legal abortion. When you add up the carnage of that, it is daily one half the casualties of the World Trade Center. Think about that for a minute, because while our attention was rightfully riveted on one tragedy, the other one continues day after day, month after month, year after year, and it's allowed to continue, quite frankly, by anti-choice politicians in our government. We alone would be able to change that.
International human rights groups have criticized the global gag rule for being undemocratic because it denies some women rights and medical access that are more readily available to women living in the United States. Stephen Sinling says women and reproductive rights groups in America need to take heed of what's happening overseas.
If the president had his way, abortion simply would not be available as a choice to American women. We were simply the defenseless victims of a policy which, if they could do it, they would apply with equal severity in the United States.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ginger Otis.
And you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Last week, the INS added five more countries to its list requiring special registration for men over 18 to include Indonesia, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, and Bangladesh. Meanwhile, in other matters of immigration, in the 40 years after gaining independence from the British in 1962, Jamaicans needed only a return ticket and some spending money and a sponsor who would meet them at the airport to enter the UK. All that, however, changed last week when they became the latest group of persons entering the UK to require a visa. Ian Forrest has more.
Thank you for calling the British Consulate General, New York. The consulate will be closed on Monday the 20th of January for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Please note that nationals from Jamaica now require visas to visit the United Kingdom.
When British Home Secretary David Blunkett made the announcement, he spoke to the benefits of the new visa requirement, saying Jamaicans who had become accustomed to waiting for 2 hours or more to be admitted would now save time. In fact, before the announcement, some Jamaicans, in addition to the long delay, had the unfortunate experience of being put on a return flight to Jamaica because immigration authorities, for one reason or another, determined they would not set foot outside the airport. In the six-week period leading up to mid-December last year, some 20% of all visitors to Britain refused entry came from Jamaica. The British Home Secretary, in making the announcement, also cited the reason for imposing the visa requirements as the high number of Jamaicans who would come to the UK on a visit and simply not return. While Mr. Blunkett downplayed the involvement in crime and violence of a number of Jamaican nationals there, a spokeswoman in the Telegraph newspaper said the policy had been introduced for immigration reasons, but obviously we are in very close cooperation with the government of Jamaica, which includes the fight against drugs. End quote. Erwin Clare of the Caribbean Immigration Services assists members of the Caribbean community to legitimize their status in the United States and is concerned that in these new restrictions there will be the room for discrimination.
The process right now where the United States grant visas is largely subjective. You must prove as a person entering the United States that you will not be a flight risk, that you will return. That is somebody looking into the future that you will return to the country you're from. As such, they require you to have documentary evidence that you own half of the country from which you're coming from. And you will find, too, that people will say in the system that if you are of a certain ethnic persuasion, you have no problems. And that has been proven time and time again. We feel that this situation could lend itself to the situation here as far as the UK requesting visitors' visas.
Nayaba Arinde, a reporter of the Daily Challenge in New York, is a British national of Nigerian ancestry. She is not surprised by the move, but views it as ironic, considering the long involvement of the British in shaping Jamaica's history.
If you control that country for a while, and in effect you determine the history of that country for a very long while, the people have a right, I would have thought, to come and go when they felt like it. So if you naturally say, well, you know what, we don't want you anymore, there's too many of y'all, come on now, hold it back. Hey, that's about something else. That's probably about economics. Like I said, I'm not surprised by it, but I think it's deeper than that. And I do think they're going to transfer this to other groups. So people from other Caribbean islands and other African nations need to watch it. But people shouldn't feel comfortable saying, well, it's just the Jamaicans or it's just the Nigerians, because guess what? Tomorrow it might be anybody else.
Dr. Basil Brown, Consul General at the Jamaican Consulate in New York, suggests that Jamaicans in the US who want to visit the UK should contact the British Consulate nearest to them to get all the details and fees. Erwin Clare believes that Jamaica and the Caribbean should consider the imposition of visa restrictions of their own.
I think that the time has now come that just as how UK and the United States have concerns about those who enter its border, Jamaica and the rest of the Caribbean need to now start figuring out a way whereby it will not impact severely on their tourist product, but they should have some mechanism to make available as to who is entering. It's not a matter of fighting back, but we also have to develop a consciousness as it relates to security for our nations and our borders.
Just before Jamaica, Zimbabwe, late last year, was the latest in a growing list of countries whose nationals required a visa to enter the United Kingdom. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ian Forrest.
The grievances of family members and advocates of more than 2 million prisoners in the country are many. In Albany, New York, more than 200 demonstrators took to the streets earlier this week to call attention to these problems. WBAI's Leslie George has more.
We are the people!
We are the people!
The mighty, mighty people!
The mighty, mighty people!
Fighting for justice!
Fighting for justice!
And no more prisons!
Their goal is prison reform, and there are many issues. Improper health care, lack of rehabilitation, exploitative prison labor, children lost in foster care, guard brutality, arrest sweeps that lock up juveniles in greater numbers, and non-existent transitional programming to help prisoners return to society. The demonstrators, including prisoners' families and former prisoners, all agreed on the greatest wrong, and that is that with only 5% of the world's population, the United States uses 25% of the world's jail cells. In New York State alone, prisons have increased in number from 12 in the early 1970s to 70. And New York's Governor George Pataki wants to build more. Reflecting national trends, protesters also say New York State's prisons are flooded with nonviolent drug offenders, and that corrections departments are increasingly relying on solitary confinement and special housing units as a management tool that is especially harmful to the mentally ill. Dr. Alice Green, executive director for the Center for Law and Justice in Albany, New York, says that not only is the criminal justice system racist, with almost 3,500 African-American men incarcerated per 100,000 versus 449 white males, but that the corrections system is also rife with racism. In New York State, she says prisoners, 85% of them black and Latino, are managed by corrections staff that is 95% white. She says the security personnel's insensitivity and ignorance of other people's cultures and circumstances escalates tensions inside prisons.
We're looking to be recognized as people, and we want people to understand that we are people and that we want to be treated with justice that is equally, fairly throughout the system, throughout this country, throughout this state. We have to understand that racism plays a major role in the whole thing, that this is one way of controlling people, one way of getting rid of social problems that we haven't decided that we want to handle and deal with. It has to do with the unequal distribution of resources in this country, and mainly for people who are people of color get nothing. And one of the ways of keeping racism alive and well is to put people in prisons, and it's also one way to hide the problems of this country, the economic, political, and social problems.
Anna Heron, one of the marchers, says her husband was brutally beaten by corrections officers over the Christmas holiday. She says he was beaten by several officers in his cell with his hands handcuffed behind his back. The day she visited him, he was in a body cast and she didn't recognize him. The following day, she drove to Albany to see if someone in the state capitol would help.
I came here on December 26th and I was turned away by a deputy. He intimidated me and I got scared. I says I thought I was going to be arrested for just coming here and express my concern. I'm an American citizen. I'm a taxpayer, and I am a registered voter. I was not able to speak. I was not able to voice my opinion. I was not able to tell them what they've done to my husband.
We need the corrections officers in the prisons to be accounted for what they've done.
Maria Farron.
They are able just to run rampant throughout these prisons and do horrid things to these inmates. They don't need to be treated like animals.
Farron is one of the demonstrators who says prisoners are also abused at the parole board. Her husband, who has been in prison for 30 years, has been eligible for parole for the last decade. Governor Pataki has proposed legislation that would eliminate parole for all felony offenders in New York State. This week's marchers, however, are determined to fight back on a number of their grievances, including health care for prisoners. Several are lobbying state officials to pass a bill that would provide better treatment of prisoners with AIDS, HIV, and hepatitis C, and to halt the spread of these diseases behind the walls. For Free Speech Radio News in Albany, New York, I'm Leslie George.
Just 2 days after anti-war activists took to the streets to demonstrate against a U.S. military campaign in Iraq, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy denounced U.S. involvement in Iraq, saying, quote, it would undermine the U.S. war against terrorism and feed a rising tide of anti-Americanism overseas. Meanwhile, union members participated in this weekend's massive anti-war demonstrations in large numbers, angry not only at the Bush administration's war moves against Iraq, but at the potentially huge economic costs associated with it. Labour has played an early and strong role in the emerging peace movement around the nation and promises to expand that role with a newly formed National Labour Organisation. Vanessa Tate has more.
Labor has been lining up against the war in droves. Over 70 labor bodies, including several national unions and AFL-CIO labor councils, have passed resolutions against the war. At this weekend's marches in Washington and San Francisco, unions had a substantial presence, not only in the streets, but on the podium. Brenda Stokely, president of AFSCME District Council 1707, addressed the Washington march.
African Americans, people of color, and poor white folks are going to be the ones out on the front lines and be the ones coming back in the body bags. We must say no to this war. We must fight to stop it.
Among union members, there is outrage at the immorality of the war, as well as widespread skepticism towards the Bush administration's claims. Michael Letwin, co-founder of New York City Labor Against the War.
Weapons of mass destruction, brothers and sisters, are really weapons of mass distraction. They're a distraction from oil. They're a distraction from the disastrous economy at home, and a distraction from the fact that it's working people, poor people, who will pay for this war. We'll pay for it with blood. We'll pay for it with our social services. We'll pay for it in every way that we've paid for every war.
During the Vietnam War and even the 1991 Gulf War, many unions were reluctant to take a stand against U.S. aggression. But labor today is less insular and more connected to other social and economic justice movements. Dana Frank, a professor of labor history at the University of California, who was marching in San Francisco's demonstration as a member of the American Federation of Teachers, says demographic changes in the labor movement account for some of the shift.
Certainly a very different story from the Vietnam War, and partly because a lot of people of color are concerned about why are we dropping bombs on people of color all over the world, a lot of people of color that make up rank and file the labor movement, all the immigrant presence in the labor movement. I think also a lot of working people and the unions, which of course work for working people, are concerned about the whole economic effects of this war. How are we going to pay for this when we have an economy that's in the sewer?
Frank adds that the renewed activism is significant because it comes from the ranks of both labor leadership and ordinary workers. In mid-January, representatives from 76 unions gathered in Chicago to found a new national organization, which immediately passed a resolution against an unprovoked war on Iraq. With initial funding of $30,000 donated by unions such as SEIU, AFSCME, and the Teamsters, U.S. Labor Against the War promises to be a powerful force within the peace movement. Bob Mullenkamp, former Teamster organizing director and a co-founder of the new organization.
We set a goal of having 200 unions sign on to the resolution we passed by the end of the month. We are marching together at demonstrations, all of labor, not scattered, but all together under U.S. Labor Against War, which we just did this weekend in San Francisco and Washington. We'll be doing that in other demonstrations. We will be raising money to do ads, and we will mostly importantly expand the anti-war sentiment and activity within the labor movement, especially within international unions.
Mullenkamp says he expects even greater participation from labor in the nationwide marches set for February 15th. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vanessa Tate.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at WBAI by Kata Mesta. Headlines editors from WMNF in Tampa, Florida are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abrams. Our DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Technical producers at KPFA in Berkeley are Jade Padgett-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. We have web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our interns are Carlos Favara and Rosalind Fay. I'm Deepa Fernandez.